Welcome to Mind Matters News. I'm your still entrepreneur wannabe, Robert J. Marks, and I'm your host. We've been talking to entrepreneur David Copps. He has over two decades of experience pioneering advancements in artificial intelligence and other emerging technology. He is the founder and CEO of a company called Worlds. So, David, welcome back, and it's going to be good to talk to you, and I want to talk to you today about starting a company, and I know that you that you have a lot of experience in doing that and have a lot of very firm thoughts in doing that. One of the things I know about starting a company is you can't go in kind of half-motivated. I think that if you go to startup people and say, give me some money, and they say, well, and you say, well, I have another job, and I can put 20 hours a week in it, they're not going to be interested in that. You got to be whole in. So let me begin with a question. How do you identify an idea that has the potential to become a successful company? There's lots of good ideas out here. I think that some of the artificial intelligence stuff is really, really good. But having it come from academicians and companies which we won't go into detail, I'm not sure that they have a good business plan. That's not the way to do it. You have to have an idea of what forming a successful company is and what constitutes a successful company. The other, a related question is, what role does passion play in choosing the right business to start?
It's a great question, because I think sometimes I mentor a lot of entrepreneurs now, you know, because I can tell them all the things I did that didn't work and save them some time. But I think I don't particularly go looking for ideas. Usually that's not what comes first. For me, it's always been the problem comes first. Like, you know, what problems are out there that need to be solved? And how could you as an entrepreneur start to take what you know and what you could create to solve those problems in a way that's not evolutionary, you know, that's kind of the way it works. You know, it's like, I also spend an inordinate amount of time trying to predict the future. I'm a voracious reader. So I consume podcast content, and I watch more YouTube than probably anybody in the world. And because I get to direct what I watch, you know, and when I hear about new technology, what excites me is not about the technology itself, but how exciting it could be applied towards a certain problem. And so that's why I'm so interested in AI, and it kind of fell into it 15, 20 years ago. And now I'm, you know, now things are just kind of going nuts. But I've always had this thought that this technology could change the world, you know, and it's certainly doing that. But so I think the short answer to that was I don't chase ideas. I become really engaged in problems, and then my way out of the problem is to think about it with technology. Like, how could we utilize technology, things that exist today and maybe don't exist yet, like that could exist if we put the right people on it. And that's probably the most exciting part for me. I like building things that haven't been built before. Like, there's no recipe, there's no cookbook, right? There's just you and possibility and some smart people in a room trying to figure out how to make this thing fly. And that's my favorite part, I think. I'm not very good at following recipes, and I really mean that. Like, my wife laughs at me. I'll never pick up a recipe. I always wing it when I'm cooking. It's probably the same way I build companies.
So that comes from an innate talent, though, doesn't it?
I think so. You spend your life thinking about things and learning things and trying things. And so you walk into these situations informed, you know, and I think where I probably have a sickness is I think entrepreneurship chose me. I don't think I chose it. I think I have a very high tolerance for risk, which is maybe unhealthy. I'm not happy unless there's some risk, you know, like I think it's sort of oxygen for a startup, you know, like if there's no risk and you have the right people, they're bored, you know. Risk actually creates kind of an urgency to figure something out. And so I like that. I think it's, my wife says I'm unemployable, and so that's why I start companies. Okay. That's probably right. I think she's right. I'm a terrible employee. That's because I'm always trying to think of a different way, a better way, not just do the current one, you know. So.
So I think what you're saying is that you like these dopamine hits from this idea of danger. Yeah. You're probably like the bungee jumping guy who's ready to bungee jump, and you have all of this danger and uncertainty in front of you, and all of this dopamine comes up, and it feels kind of really, really interesting. And then you jump and you just have a release of such great, great feelings. You know, I faced my risk, I did it. And that reward has to be something in itself.
Yeah, 100%. I think bungee jumping is a pretty good example, or a pretty good analogy too, because you do have that, there's trust, right? Like when you leap in a startup, part of what makes that leap so easier is you trust everyone around you. Like, we can do this. I know we can do this.
I think doing a startup is like jumping and not sharing that the bungee cord will work. So that would be that would be kind of interesting.
I don't think I would never jump unless there was a good cord. But.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Me too.
That's a different kind of risk.
let me ask you this. You know, forming a company, a new entrepreneur that has never formed a company, really has a lot of obstacles in front of them.
Yeah.
They don't have the reputation to fall back on. And so what were some of the biggest challenges you faced when you started your first company? And what advice would you have for young budding entrepreneurs to start a company? That has to be difficult. That has to be the biggest hurdle to jump, I would imagine. I don't have the experience like you do, but.
No, you're right. I think I'm the kind of a person that like some people, you'll ask that question, they'll get very tactical with you. And I'm not that. I'm more kind of a mindset guy. Like, I think a big portion of what you do as a startup leader has to do with mindset, not just yours, but everyone around you, your collective mindset, which is culture, right? And so when the challenges for me, like when I started my first company, that's the first one. The hardest one is the first one, 100%, because you don't know anything. You're trying, everything you're doing is new, and everything you're trying, you know, could or could not work. You're not smart yet. you know about what you're doing, but you don't know how to create it as a business. And so for me, the first ones are the hardest ones. That's when you're finding out who you are as a leader. It's where you discover your, what I call your winning formula. Like, and everybody gets that has a winning formula. It's what you do when you're faced with difficult situations. There's a winning formula. There's something you do that always works for you. And you have to build your winning formula. And that happens when you're building your first company. You know, because you're going to find adversity. If you want to learn how to deal with adversity, do a startup, because there's a lot of things that can go wrong. You know, but you know, if you have the persistence, I heard someone say once, and I've really kind of taken it with me, that persistence is omnipotence. You know, like when times get tough, focused, persistent attention, and constantly iterating as you learn will lead you to greatness every time. And so, if you want to try to get somewhere in life and in business, don't stop until you get there. and don't be married to your idea. That's the other thing I would tell people, is that one of the things I tell startups, and I mentor them early startups, is don't fall in love with your idea. If you create a 3-year vision and 3 years from now you hit it, that means you weren't paying attention.
Really?
You should have learned things along the way that had you change, you know? So that's probably not a very, most people wouldn't say that, but I think especially now, as fast as things are moving, long-term visions are, not in a startup, are kind of ridiculous. You have to pay attention. Now, when you get more established and now you have a product that does a certain thing, you can be a little bit more predictive and things like that. But when you're starting out, you really have to listen more than you talk. Like, just what are markets telling you? What are clients telling you? How can you change? Like, is the product maybe going to be different? Are you going to build it differently because of what you're learning? Because really, when you put something out there, all it is an idea. It's not a, you know, you don't put out something that you know you're going to be doing 10 years from now in a startup. You put something out as an idea. And then I almost think like it's the way that AI works, right? With AI, we have what we call reinforcement learning, human feedback, right?
Yes.
Same thing with a startup. You throw something out there and you want to see what people think, what markets think, you know, and potential clients think. And that's when you start the real learning. It's not when you build the product.
Okay. So I think the biggest challenge for new entrepreneurs is raising capital. What strategies would you recommend for raising capital as a new entrepreneur, somebody without this track record?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think, again, in your first ones, it's a lot harder. I don't take for granted my situation right now. I raised $10 million in a Series A for this company, Worlds. And we didn't have anything but a PowerPoint presentation. We had no technology, but it was only possible because I've built a couple successful companies. My partner and I, Chris Rohde and I, we built a couple successful companies and people wanted us to do another one, you know, and we wanted to do another one. So I don't take that for granted. And your first ones, you know, you really have to do unnatural things to raise money.
Unnatural things.
What I mean is just that you do whatever it takes, you know, like, I like strategic investment, like whatever you're building, like what industry will it affect? And are there companies in that industry that have corporate venture capital funds? And so I like that idea, like trying to align with strategics and early because they have a vested interest in your success. Like find people that will have a vested interest in your success and get them as investors. You know, so that's one thing I would tell people. Another one is don't chase money. I think the mistake that most startups make is they raise money for money's sake. Like they raise money because it's there. That's not the reason to raise money. I'm very picky with my investors now. I won't work with anyone unless I feel like they can really add and be a multiplier for our company. Because you know, for me, money is everywhere. It's now who do you want to partner with to create greatness together? You know, and that's why I'm very picky about investors. But in your first ones, you can't be so picky. So try some strategies like go to a strategic and definitely get in an incubator, like, you know, the Capital Factor thing or in Health Wildcatters and DEC and things like that. But it's important to get involved in communities and find investors and mentors and things like that. The more networking you do, the better. I kind of tell the startup CEOs, you've got to become a storyteller. If you're going to raise money, you have to tell a good story. And I'm not saying story like a fake thing. I'm saying like a real story. You need to be able to paint a picture of what the world looks like today and what it'll look like after, you know, your company is in the market. Okay. And because investors don't just buy technology. The biggest mistake I see startups making when they try to go to investment is they focus on how. Here's how it works, right? Because we're all technologists. So here's how it works. This happens and that happens. And investors don't care. They do care, but they care later about how. What they want to know now is, what are you doing? Why is it important? Who will it affect? How are you going to go to market? Who's going to buy this? You know, those things are most important. If I can get through those, then we'll talk about the how. But entrepreneurs tend to start with the how. Don't start with the how. Start with what and why.
I would imagine that networking, as you mentioned, is fundamental to raising initial capital. I tell my kids, for example, that it is who you know in terms of your success, but you control who you know. And in doing that, you can do great and wonderful things. I also tell them that if you're in a room and you have somebody that you're scared to talk to, say the governor walks in, all of a mm-hmm. sudden there's this inherent fear that you don't want to talk to him. I say, yeah. Pick out the person in the room that you're most afraid of, force yourself to go out and engage in a conversation with them.
Yeah.
And it might be awkward for the first few sentences, but eventually it'll get down to a good conversation. And, I would imagine, again, that the networking was very important in terms of doing this and in terms of raising capital. And I'm not sure good ways to do that in terms of researching it. How would you research it? How would you research that?
Well, I'll say right off the bat, what you just said is brilliant. Like, that's exactly what you should do. Like, I told both my sons that, you know, when you're in your 20s, now it's time to start to plant seeds. Like if I could do anything different in my career, looking back on it, it would have been I planted more seeds earlier on. Because I'm here to tell you, they always come back. Like if there's somebody you can help do something or have a conversation, later on that conversation is going to come up and you're going to get a phone call. And so plant seeds, lots and lots of seeds. And I love your idea of being brazen about it. Like if you're scared of somebody, the best thing is to go talk to them. Because I think what you're going to find out 9 out of 10 times is that person really appreciates that you came up and had the courage to talk to them. And they might even ask you a question. You know, like I think people are a lot more willing to speak with you than you think they are. And so I give the same advice. It's like, who are the best people you could be speaking with right now? And reach out to them. Do it.
And I think what's interesting, if you go to somebody, then they don't necessarily have to be a rainmaker, or not a rainmaker, mm-hmm. but a source of capital at the time. I'll tell you a little story that happened to me. When I was in Seattle at the University of Washington, I worked with a guy named Hal Philip. Now, Hal Philip was this great entrepreneur, and I'll tell you a little bit more about him in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But he was a great entrepreneur, and all of a sudden he got sued by Fluke. Have you heard of Fluke?
No.
The Fluke Manufacturing Company? Okay, they make kind of electronic equipment. And he went into this partnership with them where they were jointly developing an oscilloscope with new technology. And they were very litigious, and they later actually got sued and lost for, what do they call it? It's when you oversue somebody. I forget what it's called, but they got accused and convicted of that. But that was happening to Hal. He spent all of his money on attorneys. He foolishly signed that he had to go to binding arbitration, and he went in, and he didn't have money for a lawyer, so he went in himself, and the lawyer for Fluke came in, and what they do is they assign another attorney to sit there and make the judgment for what happens. Well, he came in, and the Fluke attorney came in, and the arbitrator said, "Hi, Frank, how you doing? How's the kids?" You know, it was totally cooked. And he went bankrupt, and he went into hiding, and I got involved in it. I actually got subpoenaed to give a deposition about his whereabouts. And it was just terrible. And we were friends. He was bankrupt, but he left the United States. And the reason I did it was because it was right.
Right.
It was, he was in the right. And I wasn't looking for, anything. And he ended up picking up his stuff and moving to Europe. And he started a company there called Quantum Research. Now, it turned out Hal was a great inventor. Okay, you ready for this, Dave? He invented modern touchscreen.
Really?
Yes. And he invented modern touchscreen, and he licensed it all over the place. Apple came out with the iPod, and they were using his technology, and he sued Apple, and he won.
Wow.
Because he had the wherewithal. He picked himself up after all this adversarial stuff. And it's just an incredible case. But what was the feedback for me? I wasn't doing it looking for any reward. But it turns out he gave me, I think, a quarter of one share of his company. Yeah. When he sold it for millions of dollars, I got enough money to pay my house off.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So, yeah, so it's an incredible story. So I think a lot of what you're saying, and I agree with you, is do the right thing all the time. And see, the thing mm-hmm. is, Hal and I still remain friends. And why is that? Because he knew mm-hmm. I was friends with him when he was down and out. Now when people approach him, they might think, well, Hal, I want your money. They might come up to him in a friendly, way, but maybe they have an alternative motive. So, but he knows with me that we were friends because we were friends, and that was really good. So I think that's an example of the sort of stuff you're talking about.
That's right. And you said something that hits home with me is just always do what's right, even when it's hard. Always do what's right.
Yes. Yes. In fact, I saw in the Babylon Bee advice for the new year, and one's from Satan was follow your heart. Do what is in it for you. And I think that the alternative to that is do what needs to be done when it needs to be done, whether you like it or not. And we know what's right. We know what's right, and we need to go ahead and pursue that. So that's great advice. So looking back at the businesses you've founded, and you've touched on this a little bit, but what leadership qualities are most essential for a founder? If I want to start a business and I want to be an entrepreneur, what leadership qualities should I have? Because the founder has to be a leader.
Yeah, it's a great question. When I saw that on the list, I was thinking, why am I thinking so hard about this? Like, why does it? But it's my leadership style's really changed over the years. And I go back to what a good leader does best is inspire people, and to guide an organization in a way that people want to be involved. They want to work hard. They want to be part of it. You've got to create that environment. Like, you can't deal with people without creating a good environment. I think that's one thing that people kind of miss is that, like, it's one thing to sit in a room with somebody, but what's the environment? What company? What have you created around them? And so I focus a lot on creating an environment. So we do several things. Like, one of the things we do is we try to take out all distractions, right? So one of the distractions is, of course, things like healthcare. So I don't want people thinking about that when they're here. I want to take that off the table. And so we are a startup that pays 100% of healthcare.
Wow.
And that's
okay.
It's unusual. And when I get investors, I tell them that. I said my people costs are going to be really high because I want people thinking about, you know, what they're inventing and innovating on, not worrying about healthcare. So we do 100% of healthcare. We pay market or better salaries. And, you know, then we build a culture that people, a place where people want to be there. You know, we have a 98% retention rate, 99%. Wow. It's crazy. Like, people don't leave when they come on board. But I think that's kind of part of it. Like, you've got to create an environment where people can fly. And if you don't, then all the conversations you have with people are empty. You've got to create that environment where not only it gives your words meaning. Like, when you say something, you they can see it in the culture that you really care about people and you care about them being able to do things they couldn't do anywhere else. Like, you, I love talking to developers, engineers, you know, because, you know, it's probably better than anybody. Engineers are very, you know, right brain. Like, you start to talk foofy on them and you lose them.
Yeah. In fact, engineers, you can tell them because their heads lean slightly to the right. Yes.
Yeah. But I love it because I get challenged on stuff. Like, when I tell people that failure doesn't exist in this company. I remember one time I was doing my startup talk at a Tech Wildcatters, and this engineer stood up and raised his hand. And he challenged me on it. And he said, "Hey, I think that's wrong." I said, "Okay, what do you think?" Because I made the statement that failure doesn't exist in nature. All there is what happens and what happens next. And he came out and said, "Well, I'll give you an example of failure." And he said, like, a pack of elephants, herd of elephants is going in there. He's challenged by a lion and the lion kills the leader. And I said, "Okay, well, what happened was a lion killed an elephant. Your interpretation of that is that he failed. I could make a different interpretation that he was a hero." So all that matters in startups and I believe in life is understanding what happened and then what are you going to do next? Like, that's all that matters. What happened and what you're going to do next. Whether that was a failure or a success doesn't matter. You know, I go into companies where they really put an emphasis on failure, like, whose fault was it? You know, and I don't care about any of that. If we had a culture that gave attention to failure, we'd all be depressed because we're building things that have never been built before. And so things won't work every day. Every day something breaks. Every day we fall down. You know, so you have to kind of say, I got it. It's just about what happened, what I'm choosing to do next. Recast failure as iteration, then iterate and iterate and iterate until you reach awesome or choose to stop. I didn't say fail in there anywhere. And I get the game. You know, it's a mindset, right? But that's a tough one for engineers.
It is. And I think that that's one of the secrets of Elon Musk. In listening to his biography, he liked to do things and he liked to look at the over-engineering and then cut back and cut back and cut back and keep cutting back until it failed and then add a little bit on. And that's what you need to work. So he celebrated failure. And he said, every time you fail, you learn something. And I think this is what you're saying too.
Well, it's not a new concept. I mean, Thomas Edison, right?
Oh, yes.
Like, yeah, he said, I didn't fail, but I found 1,500 ways that didn't work.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I love that. By the way,
you know what Tesla said? Mm. Tesla said Edison was really stupid because if he would have been familiar with chemistry and electricity, he would have reduced the number of things that he was going to test to maybe 500 or so. So, there is that too. So we've talked about some of the things that are necessary for a new entrepreneur that wants to get a startup company. Let's do the negative. If you could go back to your first startup, what would you do differently? What mistakes that have you made that you would advise other people not to make?
Oh boy. I think my short answer to that is I wouldn't change anything, right? And the reason I say that is because who I am today is a result of that experience. Not just what worked, but what didn't work. And so I don't know that I would change anything, but I learned a lot. Does that make sense? Like, I don't wish it to be different, because if it was different, I wouldn't have learned what I've learned. So it's more to me, the question to me is more about what have I learned from that and what would I do different next time? And so, you know, that list is long, right? I mean, there's lots of things that I wish I'd that I now know I could do better, you know, and because I've learned so much. But I don't think there's anything that I regret or wish was different.
That's interesting. I used to ask my dad, I would say, what would you do different if you went back in life and you had to live it over? And he gave the same response you did. He says, I wouldn't do anything different because I wouldn't be married to your mother. I wouldn't have you as a son. I wouldn't have Ray, my brother, as a son. He said, I would not do one thing different because it would change what I have now. And what I have today is exactly what I want. I am blessed.
That's right. Yeah. I kind of have this also to pile on top of that, because I think that's brilliant. I think that this is partly getting back to, you know, my surgery and what I learned from that. And then, like, perfect is what's happening right now. Whether you like it or not is not as relevant, but understanding that what's happening right now is perfect. And if you believe that, then you're free to change it.
Yes.
You know, I made up this funny slide in my startup deck about perfection. I said, you know, one of the things that kills startups is the pursuit of perfection. Perfection to me is like trying to teach a bear karate. Okay. Because it's really, really hard. And if you're successful, it will kill you. So I think that's, perfect is what's happening right now. Whether you like it or not, it's perfect. Now, what do you want to do to change it? You know, I think sometimes we live a little too much in that space between where we are today and where we wish things were. And that's not, you know, it's great to be informed by that, but not to live there, right? Be happy and understand that what's happening right now, regardless of what it is perfect. And if you believe it now, you're free to change it.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question about, again, qualities that an entrepreneur and a CEO need. You have to live a very disciplined life in order to succeed. So for the budding entrepreneur, what personal habits or routines have helped you succeed as an entrepreneur?
Yeah. It's funny because I was picturing when you said that if some of my friends who know me really well heard that you had to be very disciplined, they would just crack up laughing, you know, because I'm not that guy.
Interesting. Okay.
But I am. Obviously the older and the wiser I get, I think, but some of the things are understanding what you're not good at. You know, I think when I met my partner, Chris, you know, he and I are very different, but we're an incredible yin and yang, because I am the think about the future, what's possible for you, what's possible for people. Like, that's the lens that I use when I look at the world. And Chris is the get shit done guy. He is the one that's like, okay, great, but what are we going to do to make that real in the world? And he's the one that goes out there and just, you know, step by step makes it real in the world. And so we're a great partnership. We are a true yin and yang. And so I think that's one thing, is understand what you're not great at. And if it's something you want to be great at, then sure, go learn it. But there are things that, like for me, it's like business operations. I'm not an operations guy. I'm a leader, but operations and how you structure, you know, a company for hypergrowth, that's a real skill. I have a COO, Todd Stiles. He's just fantastic at that. And he's second company together. You know, he's really good at that. My CFO, Kristen, she's incredible with numbers. She can do things with numbers that I could never do. And I would never do a company without her, because she makes numbers sing. You go to an investor's. And so those are all things that if I wanted to, I could try and do myself. But understand what you're not great at and go find that in other people and get them in your business. You know, and so I think that's a big thing. And I think also don't chase money. It won't get you anywhere. Money follows. Like, if you do something great, money will follow.
That's really interesting, you know, because there's a parallel here in academia. In academia, currently, you are rewarded if you publish papers and you're a rainmaker in the sense that you bring in external funding. And you have a lot of people, a lot of professors, a lot of my colleagues that are interested in putting on their CVs the fact that they attracted all of this money. And so they do. They chase money. Mm-hmm. But I tell you, the big giants in the field, the people that do great things, stick to what they're good at, and they don't chase money. So I think that there's a parallel there in academia for what you're saying in business. Gosh, the guy that won the Nobel Prize in physics last year,
yeah.
Jeffrey Hinton, He just stayed with neural networks all the time. That's mm-hmm. exactly what he did through the AI winters and everything else, and wasn't a chaser of money, and developed a great legacy of accomplishment. So
I think that's
true. That's interesting.
Because I'm one that strongly believes that leadership is less about strategy and more about being. Like, you know, there's only one great measure of a leader, and it's not about who you are individually, but rather who you are for everyone around you.
Yes.
And so it's who are you being every day? Now, I'm using being as a verb. It's such that every person around you is free and empowered and encouraged to explore their greatness. You know, and so I'm happiest when I'm testing the boundaries of what's possible with a team that's motivated to figure it out. That's when I'm happiest, you know? And so I'm more interested in what's possible for people than a technology, because the technology will follow, the money will follow, all that stuff will follow.
Exactly. Because once you develop the reputation by staying, if you will, on the area that you want, as opposed to chasing money, you develop a reputation.
That's right.
And then eventually people are going to come to you. And that sounds like your experience, that now you've developed the reputation that indeed people will pursue you because you haven't chased the money.
That's right. We call it a honeypot, like create the honeypot. Everyone's attracted to the honeypot.
Exactly.
Employees, investors, everybody.
So let me ask you one final question as we wrap up here. What legacy do you hope to leave? Do you think about your legacy? What legacy do you hope to leave in the entrepreneurial and the tech world?
Personally, you know, if I were to put something on my tombstone, it would be that he was somebody that sought greatness in every person he met. Like, I want that. I want to be remembered for helping people be great, you know, and that I lived a life that wasn't about me. It was about who I was for other people. Like, that's what I want my legacy to be. And then as a company, I'm hoping Worlds in particular will be remembered for being a company that built AI for good, that we're a company that built AI that helps people. So it's a company that helped people be their very, very best at what they do because they partnered and used Worlds. I think that's a legacy we want as a company.
Okay. That's a good legacy. I think about legacy all the time. I think, though, that a lot of people that are really great don't think about their legacies. They're more interested in doing what needs to be done.
That's right. All about doing. It's more about being.
Exactly.
Less do, more be.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Dave. We're going to continue our conversation with Dave on the next podcast. We're going to talk specifically there about the companies that he's founded and the company he's currently the CEO of. And what that's like and what they do and how it's related to artificial intelligence. We've been talking to entrepreneur David Copps, who has over two decades of experience pioneering advancement in artificial intelligence and other emerging technologies. He's the founder and CEO of a company called Worlds, and their website is worlds.io. Is that right, David?
That's right.
Okay, worlds.io. And so until next time on Mind Matters News, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.